Good morning. Welcome to Level 3, Donegal, to the 2 of the county line, please, but no further, and yes, that does include you, Daniel. And so it came to pass. On Thursday evening, with rising numbers, Taoiseach Micheál Martin said he had no choice other than to act. Drive time brought us reaction.
You know, we never really got going in June whenever we reopened. We closed on the 14th of March and reopened on the 9th of June. There's still a lot of fear around. Everybody up here has known this has been coming for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
We only opened our doors at 12 o'clock yesterday, and now we've been told we're closing at 12 or at half 11 tonight. We've lost the last 6 months, the best part of the year. A lot of them are going to turn around and say, no, we're not going to bother till coming up to St. Patrick's Day again next year. They won't even bother up in January or February.
A blow for businesses and people all over the county, for sure. And yesterday, Lifford-based GP Dr. Martin Coyne joined Clare Byrne.
From March until September, the 10th of this year, we had 17 COVID cases in a practice of 9,500 patients. And between the 10th and the 24th of September, a two-week period with 54, which was, you know, a huge and shocking jump for us. We were getting an awful lot of phone calls of people looking for testing. When we talked to our patients, certainly in the initial start of this surge, there were a number of large social gatherings locally, not in a hotel setting, not in a restaurant setting, but in home settings. And they seem to have been the culprits in this particular instance.
And what are the types of social events that you have identified where the problems have been happening?
Widespread, after a football match, two birthday parties, a communion. There was also, sadly, a wake. We had just let our guard down. People are probably doing that all over the summer and thinking, well, you know, everything is fine. But all it takes is just one person to get into a situation like that, and all of a sudden we've got lots of contacts and the R number's gone crazy.
And he had some strong words for those breaking the rules.
So for people out there who don't believe in restricting themselves, for people out there who don't believe that this applies to them, that I'm going to get a mild disease, I'd say this. You are going to take this virus back to your home. You're going to take it back to somebody in your family who's vulnerable. You're going to put that person into an ICU bed and possibly kill them. And how clever are you going to be then when that happens?
Or as Michael McNamara, chair of the Special Committee on COVID-19, rather pithily put it on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
If you are going to congregate as a young person, don't visit your granny for the next fortnight because you could be bringing her COVID.
And nobody wants that. But how to get the public health message through to young people? Because with their smooth skin, shiny eyes and ability to stay up and drink and dance all night, get up, function pretty damn well, throw in some good tunes in a bag of cans and they're ready to go all over again the next night, that youthful vigour is potentially lethal. So much so that 40% of the COVID cases are to be found in people aged 15 to 34, despite being only 25% of the population. And messages like you're not invincible, just behave yourself, well, they don't seem to be landing. So in an effort to hammer home just how serious this is, Taoiseach Micheál Martin is advocating bringing back the birch. No, I'm just messing. But he does think it might be time to get down with the kids and use social media influencers to persuade, where traditional media, ourselves, is clearly not cutting it.
You also made a fair point there, I think, earlier when you instanced social media, that the mechanisms and the platforms, and maybe using more influencers to communicate at the level that young people are at in terms of the various platforms that they access, I think is key. That is happening, but I think we need to intensify that type of effort in communicating with young people.
And on Monday, Morning Ireland's Rachel English spoke to Alexandra Ryan, CEO and founder of celebrity news website goss.ie.
Unless they've been living under a rock, they must have a good idea of the guidelines at this stage. So how might influencers be able to help, do you think?
This is the thing. I think there's a consensus that everyone knows what's going on, but I actually don't think that's accurate at all. I think definitely people under the age of 30, they're not really buying newspapers. They're not watching the news at 6 every night. They are on Instagram. They are on TikTok. They are on Snapchat. A lot of them don't want to actually see the news. Like you just said there, life is tough enough as it is. So they are consuming their content through watching other people. So who are they going to trust? Are they going to watch the news and trust what's being said there? Or are they going to trust someone they've been following for 4 years? They see them make their dinner every night. They follow them on their wedding day. That's where the question lies. Is there more trust there? And I do think there is. There's a lot of people, even influencers that don't really fully understand what's going on. And I think it's very clear that the communication from the government in a whole has been very confusing to people.
But make no mistake, be it Instagram, Twitter or TikTok, influencers have a huge following. And yes, perhaps controversially, they make money from that profile.
Someone wearing a mask on their channel could massively change things, and especially 2 metres apart, speaking about that. And as we all know, the numbers are very high in the under 45 group, and house parties are the target as well. I think the argument with all of this, and I saw it last night on Twitter, is that a lot of people feel influencers should be doing this anyway. And I don't disagree with that. I think if you have a platform, you have a responsibility to educate people correctly and to behave in a certain way. But in saying that, there's ads on Dublin buses, you know, they're being paid for those ads to be on the bus. Yeah. There's people being paid for billboards. I do understand influencers are advertising models, like they do need to be paid for what they do. But, you know, I put up a question last night on Twitter and Instagram about coming on today, and there was so much negativity. So I think influencers are going to be scared to do this. And it's not about if and when, you know, the brief for this has already gone out to agencies. There are people already speaking to influencers about taking this campaign on.
All right.
Alexandra Ryan of Goss.ie with Rachel on Morning Ireland. And on Tuesday's Drive Time, the same debate was explored. And here's YouTuber Clissair, who thought TikTok was exactly right to target Gen Z. Philip, though, was not so sure.
But aren't those Gen Z audience incredibly suspicious of anything that is remotely fake? And influencers who have been paid by government to communicate a message is the very definition of what is fake, isn't it?
No, I would fundamentally disagree with you there, because that's like saying that anybody who works in media who writes a sponsored article is fake and lying.
That's a distinction that you and I can make, but is a 16 or a 15-year-old going to make it?
Well, I guess I don't know the answer to that. I think that if you pick the right influencers or the right content creators, I think she's right in that influencers is a dirty word these days, but if you pick the right content creators to talk properly and naturally about something, like, it will work. So, for example, I was mentioning that, like, I would be doing vlogs, and they're about these coronavirus restrictions and how I'm dealing with them, and they're aimed at an international audience, but, like, it would be very natural for someone like me then, who I'm showing you in my everyday life and all these vlogs, that I'm adhering to restrictions, so it makes sense for me. The problem is, if, depending on the content creators that are selected, if you're going to select content creators that it's a total left field swerve for them and they are not showing themselves to be adhering to the regulations day to day, that makes no sense.
Okay.
So I think that it can definitely be done in a very smart way, and I think it's worth a shot. I mean, we can throw out figures like 20,000 and make it seem ridiculous, but what about the 8 million reported spent on traditional advertising? I mean, what's been the return on that?
YouTuber Clissair on Drive Time. And on Thursday's Late Debate, journalist Mick Clifford looked back at all our youthful selves and fessed up to just how difficult it might be to sit in and be sensible.
People go on about young people. We were all 22 once. I mean, it's a point of your life where there's going to be the most socialisation. It's the point of your life where you're going to live forever. And when the spread is asymptomatic, as so many people have said, getting buy-in from that cohort is just really, really difficult. And I think what's happened up in Donegal in particular highlights the difficulties that we have at this kind of halfway juncture, whereby we're not in total lockdown, and at the same time we're asking people, particularly in some areas of the country more than others, to have greater restriction on their movements.
Yeah, I'm just getting a few texts in here, Mick. Older politicians, people, media workers, etc., blaming young people yet again. No mention of the awful public health service older people have created. Another one, I feel that there is too much emphasis on young people spreading the virus to old people. Young people can suffer long COVID and be out of work for 2 to 6 months. I'm 58 and I worry about long COVID in 25-year-olds. That's from Joe Barry in Dublin. It's obvious lots of people, it's a tweet from Fiona, it's obvious lots of people don't care anymore. 50% of us are still doing what's asked, the other 50% are done. Influencers and all the pleading in the world will not change this.
Ooh, text her into Katie, let's sincerely hope you're wrong. Just don't make us do a TikTok dance. No one wants to see that. On Wednesday, the Oireachtas COVID-19 committee met, and there was an opportunity to do a little international compare and contrast. Former Swedish chief epidemiologist Dr. Johan Giesecke gave his view on what lessons, if any, Ireland could learn from how they had handled COVID-19. and he advocated allowing the virus to spread in a controlled manner among people under the age of 60. He spoke to Philip on Drive Time and explained the logic behind his thinking.
Well, I think you can't get away from it. There's no way to stop this. The virus is spreading in the population, and this zero COVID or COVID zero, I don't believe that's a feasible approach.
But there's a long way from zero COVID to what you're talking about, and where we are at the moment is we're trying to shield the vulnerable and the over 75s, the over 70s. You're talking about something that's quite radically different.
No, what you just said is the main aim. Protect the old and the vulnerable. Do everything to protect people from getting very ill or from dying. That's the main aim of the, that should be the main aim of the policy. So you should do everything possible to protect these people. That's the most important bit. So it's not letting the virus run rampant in the population. It's protecting the old ones. And at the same time, seeing that we don't get too widespread in the population. So your basic statement is not correct.
And then began an over and back between Dr. Giesecke and Philip on the many differences between Ireland and Sweden.
I wonder though, are you trying to prescribe something for other countries, for countries like Ireland to take on board, that may or may not work in Sweden without looking at the wider context of the country that you're applying it to? Because, for instance, the population density in Sweden, I gather, is 25 people per square kilometre. It's 72 people per square kilometre here. This idea of a controlled spread of the virus is much harder where people are living much more closely together.
Yeah, but I'm not prescribing anything for Ireland. You have to make your own decisions. That's not up to me. I'm just saying the way it's happened in my country.
Okay, but you are holding your country up as an example to follow. I mean, that is what you said to the Oireachtas Committee today.
I don't agree with that. I just reported back on our experiences. I'm saying that other countries might do the same thing, but I'm not saying they should.
Okay, well,
that's not my. I'm not an Irishman. I can't prescribe to you or to your government what you should be doing.
Okay, but if we leave the epidemiological considerations aside for one second, and you say Ireland is a country where we have 3.1 people per house, where Sweden has a lot less, 2.1 people per house, that you're comparing apples and oranges and suggesting that other countries might consider following your example.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I mean, you have to make your own choice. I'm just presenting the experience from my country. I'm not saying that you should be something different, do something different.
I know.
That's for you to decide.
But would you acknowledge that the experience of your country is not one that applies universally?
It would apply in more countries than Sweden, I think, yes.
But might it apply to Ireland? Well, the interview finished thus.
No, but wait. What you're telling me now is a lot of things that I don't know about Ireland. And I was asked to join this committee. I didn't volunteer for it. So with all this knowledge about the Irish situation or the way your country works, I'm not aware of that. And I can't tell you that this would be better for Ireland.
Which is probably exactly my point to you, that all countries are very, very different, and seeking to apply a one-size-fits-all solution or the Swedish model is a mistake.
Could be.
It could be.
Yeah.
All right. We'll leave it there then, if that's the best that you're going to give me on that. Dr. Johan Giesecke, thank you.
Drive Time on Wednesday. So the Swedish model? Maybe not so much. But could we learn any lessons from the country where this all started? China. Just how are they doing? Well, turns out, not bad at all, cheek of them. Mark Murray is living in Changchun, and he spoke to Claire Byrne.
Everything is pretty much back to normal, and everything has reopened again. We never had the social distancing over here, but as far as everything is concerned, we're all back to normal, except the borders are closed off to the country.
And you're a teacher, and you're back in the classroom.
Yeah, as of June, we were back in the classroom. We went to online teaching in March, and we were back in the classroom in June.
And what about your social life? The pubs, the restaurants, all operating as normal?
Yeah, everything is as normal. When we went into lockdown, it lasted for about 6 weeks to 2 months, but it was at the beginning of the breakout, and everybody, I think, had a little bit more fear of it. So we kind of stuck to the rules very strictly, but it paid off in the end. So now everything's reopened, and we're pretty much virus clear.
But you have to show, don't you, on your phone, on the app on your phone, that you're clear to enter?
Yeah. So if you're going to travel on public transport, they still ask you to wear a mask and you have a health code. So everybody, it's like a QR code on your phone. They will scan it. It will turn green and they will know that you don't have COVID-19. If it pops up that it's yellow or red, this would be due to temperature testing, then they would just be refusing on the public transport. At the beginning, every shop you walked into, there would be someone standing outside the front with a temperature gun to take your reading. But now, over time, less and less people started doing it. And today, I'd go out without a face mask, go to a restaurant. I wouldn't even take a face mask with me if I'm not going to use public transport. I hope it's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel that, you know, we will get through this and things do get back to normal, you know.
A sliver of light at the end of the tunnel? Well, Mark put much of this success down to the Chinese government's vigorous testing and tracing of outbreaks. However, when Taoiseach Leo Varadkar came into Clareburn the following day, while he did acknowledge the importance of testing and tracing, he wasn't quite buying the Chinese model. At least not for here.
You know, China is not a democracy. It was able to do certain things in its country and to its people that would not be possible to do in Europe or North America. You know, very extreme measures. You know, taping people up in their homes. If you opened your door, it would set off an alarm and the police could come. You know, that's not the kind of thing we can do in a free country or a democracy, and nor would we wish to. And as well, bear in mind, any country that looks like it's doing well when it comes to coronavirus can look very differently in 3 months' time or 6 months' mm-hmm. time. And if the virus gets back into China before an effective vaccine or treatment is developed, it would probably spread like wildfire.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we should always be very careful about those kind of, you know, looking at another country example, because 4 weeks later, it can look very different.
Yet again, no easy answers on this one, I'm afraid. Back and COVID-free after this. Welcome back. Now, every so often, you need a win. And last Sunday, cyclist Sam Bennett gave us all a boost when he won the green jersey at the final stage of the Tour de France.
I can't tell you how excited I am. I never thought I'd ever be able to win this stage. And to do it in green is so special. All the suffering through the mountains, so worth it now. All the years coming, trying to come up, trying to make it. I tell you, it took me so long to get here. I'm sorry if I'm coming across too arrogant or anything, but I'm just going to enjoy every moment of it. I can't believe I got it.
A fantastic win. And on Monday, Sam's grandfather, Pat Cashin, spoke to Ray.
I was delighted to see him win yesterday. Come on, Sam!
Yeah.
You're the best boy in Tipperary.
Isn't he just amazing?
Now, not since the glory days of Shane Lowry's Emmy has a grandparent taken such delight in their grandchild.
He's a lovely boy and he's very interested in cycling, and he's dedicated all his life, his youthful life, to it. He never smoked or drank, and he was all the time on the bike cycling around.
And did
his
you?
First bike.
Yeah, go on. His first bike. I was going to ask you about
that. His bike was
a
little trolley that, when they first came over from Belgium, he spent a Christmas with his granddad and grandma, and so Alice said to me, "What'll we get, Sam?" So I said, "Why not build a small little bicycle, and he can cycle around the yard and that." And she said, "Okay." And he had a bike in the kitchen here, and I put the phone to his ear, and I said, "No, Sam." I said, "What I want you to do is, I want you to phone Santa Claus and tell him what you want for Christmas." So he put the phone up to his ear and he was goggling away like, and He was, you know, I don't know what he was saying, but anyway, I took the picture. I was a photographer for the Nationalists at the time,
right.
And we had it on the Nationalists, and I gave him that picture on the day he was getting married.
Lovely. That's a lovely moment, yeah.
Oh. And turns out Pat Cashin had a fair set of lungs on him, which he wasn't shy about using.
There's a suggestion here that you might change the words of Danny Boy to Sammy Boy and give us a blast of that before we leave you.
Oh, Sammy Boy, the boy, the boy, circling. How about that?
That's brilliant. From the Champs-Élysées to Carrigan Shore. You're brilliant.
And he was. That was Pat Cashin, granddad to Sam Bennett, with Ray on Monday. Finding Our Voice is a spoken word project from the Good Shepherd Centre in Kilkenny. Poet Colm Keegan worked with people who were homeless to help them write about their lives. And one poem that came out of this is called My Brega, with a nod to the Kilkenny River. Colm was on Arena and read the poem.
My Brega, my river, with its untrusty nature. Space for friendship, fishing for trout. Feeling pride and positive feelings, not negative. Negativity is like food when you're looking for any excuse to drink. Trust to this day. There's two or three up there. The lads' best friends. Yeah, there'd be fights, throwing digs. We'd always hold back a little bit. Next day, few cans. It's all fixed. I'll never forget. Handball in the Butts Alley. I played with the greatest, Michael Duxie Walsh. 100 games or more. I had my heart broke down there by the Brega. Didn't know it at the time, but when I told her to F off, I didn't think the drink was the problem. I chose drink over another human being. But the river, it keeps on going. I go out of my way to see it. I love looking into it. It gives me a positive feeling. It's still there. It keeps going, like me.
Colm Keegan reading My Brega from the Finding Our Voice project, as heard on Arena. Now, with all of this talk of influencers, they didn't get much bigger than Ilan Piper Leo Rousham, who was the focus for Bowman on Sunday.
There are some threads in this programme which only struck me as I was working on it, some points being made which added up seemed to be greater than the sum of their parts. That Leo Rousham was an important figure in modern Irish culture and traditional Irish music is obvious. More than that, he was the custodian of a particular tradition and one which was at some risk.
And, you know, it's very interesting to note that when Leo died in 1970, he was the only craftsman making the instrument worldwide, you know.
Was piping dying? The question was asked. That it didn't die was due to a small group of people, of whom Leo Rousham was certainly one.
Yeah, it's hard to think of that time already. I mean, I know that the late Clondemarnock was in genuine fear of the whole thing being extinct, which is real enough when you think when Leo went. And he was everything too, because he was broadcasting, he was playing, he was teaching, he was making. He was kind of Mr. Pipes, really, wasn't he?
He was the living sound, if you like, of the instrument, yeah.
And just listen to this humdinger of a recording of the Fox Chase from the 1955 Flat Keol in Loughrea. Thank you.
Now that is the sound of the crack. That was Piper Lear Rousham as heard on Bowman on Sunday. Okay, let's do Your Stupid Idea is the delightful title of a new book of essays from Patrick Frayne, and he came into Ryan on Monday.
You cut to the chase, you kick off, you're on a camping trip. I said, where is this going? And out you go to the hills of wherever it is with your dad, and you think you're going on a camping trip.
Yeah, so we had this great conversation a few years ago. Myself and my wife were visiting home, and I said, Dad, do you remember that camping trip we went on? It was like this bonding experience when I was around 12.
Yeah.
And Dad goes, oh, yeah, right. There was rumours of an IRA training camp in the Wicklow Mountains.
Yeah.
So I was sent down. My dad was in the Rangers. So we were kind of tasked with seeing if there was any truth in that. And I thought that if I brought you, we'd look like a father and son on a camping trip.
That's great.
I was like, I thought we were a father and son on a camping trip. And he goes, no. Well, we were. But, you know, I thought, you know, if people spotted us, because I'd remembered weird things, like we had a walkie-talkie. And every now and again, Dad would tell me to read coordinates in the walkie-talkie. And I thought this was just fun.
Yeah.
But it was to other army men that were in the mountains. My dad goes, it was perfectly safe. And I go, how was it safe? He goes, it was fine. I had a gun.
Oh, that's kind of hilarious. But that undercover training, so to speak, was to prove useful when it came to how Patrick managed the spotlight.
Having met you a couple of times, you strike me as being kind of not introverted, but lower key than, say, a show off like myself on the face of it. And yet you write quite stridently about being a show off. You say you are, but it's almost like you're a passive aggressive show off. Like,
exactly.
Do you know
right.
what I mean? What is that?
I don't know. Like, I realize that, like, even having the book out is strange for me, and it's like pretending I'm not a show off when you have a book that's basically about yourself falls flat.
Yeah.
If you give me an opportunity where no one is expecting me to do something cool, like sing a song or tell a funny story, that's when I'll do it.
Okay.
Whereas if you shine the spotlight on me, I'll go, not now.
So you're a sniper show off.
I'm a sniper show off.
You're not going in all guns. You'll just every now and again go, here's a great tune, sung in tune.
Yeah.
Just when you're least expecting.
Oh, no one's, who's singing? Oh, it's Patrick. Well, that's quite good.
I wasn't expecting that.
Now, Patrick is pretty funny, but not all the essays are funny, haha. Because he also talked about his own anxiety and also how not being able to have children had impacted him.
You know, I think people are quite sensitive on this issue, but some people aren't. So some people, people make assumptions that everyone has the same life. And they make assumptions that, you know, either everyone wants kids or everyone can have kids, or that everyone isn't, like, there's a lot of people who are conflicted about having kids. And if I started writing that essay a couple of years ago, and again, it was another essay I had to come back to when I felt better about things.
Mm.
You hit a certain point in your life. And for all of my talk about, like, you know, being in bands and doing kind of countercultural things when I was younger, I was largely in parallel with my peers. You know, you kind of go to school, you go to college, you might be mess around in a band for a while, but then you get a job and then you get a house. And at a certain point, you realize you're kind of drifting away. Everyone else is doing this other thing, you know, they're having kids. And one of the things I think it does is, like, positively does, is I know from all of my friends and family with kids that they don't have time to think anymore. But it makes me think a lot about the expectations that are on people, that shouldn't be on people. Something happens when people hit 30s and 40s and they have kids, then their next 20 years are mapped out by kids, you know, which is a wonderful thing in a lot of ways. And in another way, it's kind of, it's just the map. And not being on that map anymore was interesting. And I wanted to write about that.
Patrick Frayne with Ryan on Monday. Now, look who's back.
I wonder what this, what is it, Ray?
What is it, Ray?
Cheesecake.
It's your
cheesecake. Mind. It's one.
I'm getting a wig. No, I'm not getting
a wig. We've won a holiday to the hotel.
No.
Are we getting a superior room?
You're not getting a superior room.
What is a superior room? A king-size mattress.
No, this is the news.
A cheese board.
This is the news. The Den is coming back.
What?
Would you believe it? The Den is coming back.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, the Den's coming back, Zig.
For real?
Yes, for real.
Way. And look who else took the call.
Have we got him? We have. Hello, Dustin.
Hello, Dustin. Yeah. Tax man, I'm not paying anything. All them corrupt politicians going around playing golf. I am not paying a penny until this country is started out. So don't call me again.
Dustin.
This is a recorded message. message. It's us, Dustin.
Go back to bed, Grania. No, or Sheila, sorry. Just go back to bed.
Dustin, it's Dustin. Us.
Hello?
Dustin. It's not the tax man.
No, no, Dustin.
It's Dustin Zag and me.
Yes.
How are you doing? How are you doing? How are you doing? Go on, you good thing. How's the rain? Hi, Dusty.
Dustin, some good news.
For what? Claire Byrne said yes.
No, no, no. The den is coming back, Dustin. The den is coming back.
Sorry?
I said the den is coming back.
No, I heard you the first time. I'm just sorry.
This year just needs to end. And sticking with foul-mouthed, feathered creatures, parrots, yes, I did just do that, with a focus for Mooney Goes Wild, and specifically five African grey parrots, who were quite the potty mouths, so much so that they had been gifted to Lincolnshire Wildlife Park. Here's Steve Nichols.
What they usually do, most parrots, is if they want attention, they will start shouting, making not very nice noises, or doing what they do most. But obviously, if they get a reaction, and usually from a person, they've achieved what they want. But these five birds literally were sat at the side of each other. And within a couple of days, one of our assistants, she actually mentioned, said, have you heard how bad those parrots swear? And I said, yeah, but I've heard parrots swear, so don't worry, it's not that bad. But I then walked in literally within 15 minutes of walking in, one of them told me to F off. And I thought that, but then when it did that, obviously I would naturally laugh. But before I laughed, one of the other parrots laughed because they're used to hearing that. So
they're effing and laughing at the same time.
So that's it. And then as soon as he did it, another one. And I mean, some of the words are just not, literally not, no matter what they are, they're not very good for viewers or listeners because then they go into real obscenities. And we have parrots that sing, and when they sing for attention, that gets people gathering round. Well, swearing parrots do exactly the same. And when they say blue planet, I don't think David Attenborough meant this blue planet.
Both vulgar and indecent, but if parrots seem to have an anger management problem, it mightn't necessarily be their fault. They're social creatures and weren't meant to be in cages.
These monogamous flock creatures, all they actually want is another bird. They're not bothered about where they are. They just need, they like the humans. They like, they have the same social instincts as a human. They just need something else to relate to. And so they try their hardest for a couple of years and then usually contact us. And we have a number of reasons. One is usually illness, because parrots do provide an awful amount of dust and that can trigger quite a lot of illnesses off. Another one is noise and destruction and aggression, which parrots display lots of when they get to a certain age, usually through frustration of being on their own. And then of late, I think what's happened of late, COVID has actually gave people an insight into how long their parrot stays in the cage. So if you've been in lockdown for 6 months, like a lot of the world has, you're sat with, I mean, and that this has happened to a lot of people who's usually out at work, so they've actually seen their bird. And if the bird's got to that point where it is noisy and aggressive, then it stays in the cage. And they've also learned that when they go on the internet, that people are telling them the truth and saying they're not really the best pet to be sat in a cage on its own for 25, 30 years. So the realisation has just said, well, let's take them to swear at Steve up at the wildlife park because he thinks it's funny.
Steve Nichols of Lincolnshire Wildlife Park has heard on Mooney Goes Wild. And let's finish with a bit of Beyonce. There are no words. Back in a bit. Welcome back. If you listened very closely this week, there was an intriguing, slightly alternative vibe humming on the airwaves. Stories and ideas that maybe challenged our thinking. Well, one seeker was Derek Carroll, and he spoke to Ryan Tuberty. The Dublin chef had left his job to travel and connect with his environment, which had led him to become a self-appointed keeper of what he was calling the flame of fertility.
I have been burning a physical flame, a fire, for the last 10 months.
And you're bringing it from Norway to
the Hill of Uisneach. The flame is an inspiration for the people who are working the land to rethink their ways and their knowledges of profit. And for the natural wildlife, it's an incense for fertility for the birds and the bees to learn and to become part of a symbiosis of balance that will be created from the centre of Ireland, pulse from the centre of Ireland out to the world.
A noble aspiration. And while in Norway, Dara meets a pirate, as you do.
He sails into the harbour on this black, rustic
boat that looked like it didn't seem to, it wasn't looking like it was meant to float at this stage. It was banged up black, yeah. And this big, huge, tattooed pirate gets out with a huge chain of tar around his neck. And I'm fascinated about kind of, I'm journeying at this stage and I'm manifesting different things, and this boat pulls up. And then I'm like, the symbology of him, the boat and everything, I was like, I have to talk to this man. It's just meant to be.
Meant to be, all right. And this was why.
So I was doing a lot of meditating around stone circles, and I was in a place of heightened, abundant nature.
Holy
smokes. There's more microorganisms, more insects, more intellectual life, okay, really flourishing in this place. So I was lighting a lot of fires here. And the message that was coming through me every time I was lighting these fires was that I had to carry this sense of abundant fertility,
yeah,
from one place of enormous balance to another place which has lost its balance and lost its fire. Now, this is going through my head and it doesn't settle in my head very well.
Yeah.
But when a pirate comes along and offers you a boat, wood, power tools and everything you need,
yeah,
to accomplish this mission,
yeah,
you're kind of like, well, I didn't really think this was going to happen. But
the pirate like changed everything.
Yeah, the pirate kind of trusted me along the quest and was like, here, boy, you're going out to sea.
Well, this is desperately exciting. And off Dara sets from Norway to Scotland in the company of his crew, one 45-year-old Danish man with limited sailing experience.
So our first attempt failed dramatically. We got caught in a huge storm. The whole boat got smashed. The engine, the battery fell from the engine room, blended into the engine. The whole battery melted in half. And this is when your boat is rocking completely, almost capsizing from side to side, and I'm in an engine room trying to pull a battery that's melting in half out of the engine. So
where was the flame? Done. Where's the flame of fertility at this point?
The flame of fertility is in a stove burning, and then the Danish guy, he knocks over the chimney for the fire. So then, in the midst of a chaos where the boat is filling up water, I'm bailing out without with buckets. There's an open fire in the boat, and okay, there's smoke pumping through the cabin. And the Danish man, he's like totally on for the calling the rescue service, and I'm like, it's okay, we will make it back. And we did make it back, and today I calmed them down and it was all fine. We went 14 hours out,
yeah,
and it took us 15 hours to get back to square one, harbour one, with a smashed up boat, a broken engine, and thinking, what am I doing?
Nothing if not tenacious, Dara sets sail again, and he does make it to Scotland. And from Scotland, after more adventures and misadventures, he's now here in Ireland, and the mission continues. And this was how Dara explained why he felt the need to embark upon this great adventure.
The way I look at it is, over the last couple of years and over the last few places I've been travelling, I've been training myself to find my intuition, my inner voice.
Yeah.
Who is the inner voice speaking? Eliminate all the other things that are going to distract you or catch you or catch your mind or make you doubt or make you fear or make you think it mightn't be. So finding that confidence in your intuition might seem mad, because your intuition is going to go against a lot of logic that is going to speak to you consistently. So I've been training myself to learn to freely and fully, without any fear, follow intuition. No matter who around you or what is happening around you, follow that voice. So that takes a lot of meditation and a lot of deep thinking to be able to connect to that depth of knowledge which is in us all.
This might be a stupid question. I'm not trying to be smart, but what do you hope to achieve with that connection, if I can ask it that way?
With the connection is a more in-tuned life,
okay,
with nature and balance, and my environment around me portrays my inner environment.
Dara Carroll with Ryan, and that questioning spirit was behind The Science of Colour when Dr. Shane Bergen joined Claire yesterday.
In 1665, Isaac Newton, the well-known scientist, had to escape Cambridge as the plague was doing the rounds. And lockdown was the solution back then as well as it is now. And so he escaped to the countryside. And being a very privileged man, he could spend a lot of time in his garden shed experimenting. And one of the areas he was most interested in was light and the nature of light. He wondered, given that we could see things, was this something that was happening purely in our heads? Or was this light somehow out in the world? And so the first thing he did was stuck a knife, can you believe it, into his eye socket.
What?
Yeah, he didn't go blind, but he didn't uncover the nature of light in doing that experiment. Fortunately, he moved on. He darkened his shed and created a tiny pinhole in one of the walls through which sunlight shone, and it created a very clean ray. And he did experiments with that. Famously, he put a prism, a kind of a triangular piece of glass, in the way of the ray of light, and it fractured into the rainbow. So it made all of those colours. And he was a very clever man. So he thought, well, maybe the prism is creating the rainbow. Maybe there's something in the prism, like impurities or something, and that causes all of these colours. So he stuck a second prism in the way, and he was able to recombine the colours back into white light. And that was the very sort of beginning in modern times of our explanation as to what is light. So the stuff that comes from the sun is made up of all of the colours of the rainbow that we see on a sunny and showery afternoon.
So where does colour come from? What do we know now?
Well, we know that, well, lots of objects have colour, as we know. So the microphone here in front of me is the RTE blue that listeners will know. But if I were to turn off the light, it's black, right? So it doesn't give off light itself. Light shines upon it and it absorbs all of the colours except the blue, and it reflects that. And my eyes and your eyes are evolved to see the colour within it, because we have something called cones in our eyes. You've heard of rods and cones, mm-hmm. perhaps. We have three cones in our eyes. So they're red, green and blue. So it means we can pick up those colours and combinations of them.
Fascinating science there from Shane Bergen. But is my blue the same as your blue? And how does blue feel anyway? Well, on Culture File, Áine Gallagher spoke to Keith Allen at the University of York about the philosophy of colour.
The 17th century English philosopher John Locke thinks of colours as dispositions to produce sensations. So when we look at, say, a blue object, what happens is we have a certain kind of experience. We have this sensation of blue. And all it really is for something to be coloured is for the object to have a disposition to bring about that sensation. So this isn't saying that colours don't exist out there in the external world. And it's also not trying to say that colours are identical with reflectances or something like that, some kind of physical property. It's rather introducing this kind of relational mind-dependent property, so that on this account, colours exist out there in the world, but they only exist in the world because we exist and we perceive them a certain way. So what it is for something to be blue just depends entirely upon its ability to produce a blue sensation in us.
Ooh, trippy stuff. That was Culture File, and maybe that is just what we need for the strange days in which we live. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Time was when blue was the saddest. Sadder than that, blue was the bluest. Blue can be blue. No one seemed to care, least of all blue. No, blue wasn't making it. But then, on a Thursday of a year, who can remember except blue? Something sudden happened. Blue went as high as sky is high, flipped fathoms up, began to swing easy, sensibly, the way swings should be swung, like birds sing a song. Now everyone loves the new blue, 'cause it's the truest. You will too, when you see this blue, true blue, too true, true blue.